Far more possible to make a comparative study of civilizations and to examine their likenesses and differences and the put side by side the courses of their rises and their falls and see how far they coincide with each other or differ from each other. And then finally, in the human field, there is prehistory. It's hard for us to realize, I think, that 99% of human history so far has been spent by all of us, not just by people who are still primitive, by all of us, including ourselves in our Western world, spent by all of us in the food-gathering stage, which is the stage in which the primitive native inhabitants of Australia are still living today. They're the last remnant of people in the world who are still living in the food-gathering stage. We've spent so far about 1% of our history in the agricultural stage, and we've spent about half of this 1% in the civilizational stage. Civilization has existed for about 5,000 years, agriculture has existed for about 10,000 years, the human race is thought to have existed for pretty nearly a million years. So we have to remember prehistory, and remember the enormous impetus of habits that were formed by us during that 99% of our existence up to date. And from this point of view, prehistory is something living, something very important in relation to our present-day problems, because many of our present-day habits, especially some unfortunate habits like nationalism, are hangovers from that 99% of the food-gathering stage in which economic necessity compelled human beings to live split up into innumerable, very small tribes separated from each other. And that is the background to present-day nationalism, which is today, now nationalism is armed with the atomic weapon, threatening the human race with destruction, unless we can change our habit over this. The passion for hunting and fishing that all civilized people have is, of course, another hangover from the food-gathering stage. For us, these are sports or recreations, but the tremendous zest that we have for them, the kind of nostalgia we have for them, is because for 99% of the period of our existence so far, these were not sports or recreations at all. They were the means by which our ancestors earned their living. So the impulse to hunt or to fish or to gather berries or roots is very strong in human beings. The habit is deeply ingrained. And now lastly, about this expansion of our field of knowledge, comes the really new dimension that has been added to the study of human affairs by the new science of psychology. People of my age have lived to see the rise of psychology. I suppose I was already in existence at the time when the first modern psychologists were making their epoch-making discoveries. And psychology has added really a new dimension to all the humanities. And we have discovered, Freud and Jung and the others have shown to us, that the psychic universe inside each of us is as vast as the whole physical universe outside the psyche of each of us. Of course, when we say inside and outside, in reference to psychic events, we're using spatial metaphors metaphorically. We've no other language to use. But as I say, this is a whole new dimension. History, anthropology, sociology, economics, they all have to be seen in this extra dimension of psychology, as well as in the old dimensions in which we've been studying them so far. As for the expansion of the sciences, which study non-human nature, their expansion since Goethe's time, of course, has been, I suppose, still greater than that of the humanities. The number of entirely new sciences that have sprung into being since the early 19th century is, of course, enormous. And this brings us to the question, how are we to deal with the amount of things that there are now for us to know? Because this amount is really beyond any individual's capacity. It's true that thanks to the progress of scientific medicine, there's been a considerable increase in the average expectation of life. And this has reflected itself, I think, especially in this country, in a lengthening of the period of education. But there are some catches about that. One doesn't know psychologically how far it's normal or practical for human beings to extend the education period into adult life, time when one is ready to marry and to do a job and to bring children into the world and to be responsible for them. It's probably difficult to go on being educated rather than having gone on from that to have some responsible work. So we don't know quite how far it's psychologically feasible to extend the average age of education. And then again, postgraduate education so far, anyway, has tended to concentrate rather on microscopic details rather than to take the panoramic view, the generalist view. And this again isn't necessarily a last stage of education that fits one for coming out into the world of today and tomorrow, in which the great need is to have a general understanding of this vast and varied and complicated universe in which we have to live for good or evil, whether we've learned to understand it or not. If we don't understand it, it will be worse for us, so we'd better try to understand it as well as we can with our feeble human capacities. Because we can't afford not to know this unmanageably large amount of things that there are to be known now. Because we can't contract out of being citizens of this worldwide world into which not only we Westerners, but all the civilizations and all the peoples of the world have now moved. So how are we to try to reconcile these apparently irreconcilable points, to have a thorough knowledge and at the same time to have a comprehensive knowledge, comprehending this vastly expanded universe in which we now find ourselves living, vastly expanded compared to the universe of even our parents, let alone our grandparents. I think the first necessity for all of us is to acquire a general knowledge, and a general knowledge of some smattering of general knowledge of both the non-human sciences and the humanities. When I think of this, I often think back with regret to a mistake that I myself made at school. I'd been not very good at mathematics, and I didn't like them. At the age of about 16, I'd just got to a point where I might have started to get an inkling of higher mathematics, the calculus. And I was offered the choice, would you like to start the calculus? Probably you're not good at mathematics enough to go very far with it, but you get some notion of what higher mathematics is, or do you like to stop mathematics altogether and just read more Greek and Latin? As I liked Greek and Latin, didn't like mathematics, and had been left free to choose, I shouldn't have been given the choice at that age. I chose to read more Greek and Latin and never got on to the calculus, which I've since then deeply regretted. And I think this regret is right, because as C.P. Snow points out, there is this split in the modern world. Very few people today straddle both science and the humanities. Now, if one tries to straddle science and humanities, or even tries to straddle the whole of science alone or the whole of the humanities alone, much of one's this very general knowledge is bound to be secondhand and superficial, bound to be more superficial than Goethe's mastery of the smaller field of knowledge, which was at Western man's disposal between 1745 and 1830. But even superficial general knowledge is invaluable for its own sake, as well as for the practical purpose of world citizenship. I think it's invaluable from a strictly knowledge point of view for one or two reasons. General knowledge alone can make it possible for us to see the connections between particular bits of knowledge. And the connections are at least as important as the bits themselves are, because if we have just separate bits of knowledge, we don't have understanding. And knowledge without understanding, knowledge of mere facts, without understanding what the facts mean and what the is of not much value to human beings. If we have a general view, we can put the facts together, and then we can get some understanding, probably, of each and all of them. Our knowledge of the, then again, our knowledge even of the facts, even if we train our microscope on that fact and try to explore it to its last minutiae, our knowledge of the individual fact will be distorted and imperfect and therefore misleading if we don't see each single fact in its general setting, because the isolation of the fact is a purely artificial procedure of the human mind. Of course, there are no isolated facts, really. It's just a solid universe, which is an absolute continuum. It's only for practical, operational, mental purposes that we cut it up into pieces. But in cutting it up, we distort it, and less we have to cut it up, the less we shall be distorting it. So you can't understand even a bit of the universe unless you see it in the setting of the rest of the universe. At the same time, I feel sure that we ought not to be only generalists, especially someone whose bent is towards the general view, the panoramic view, ought to take care to be a bit of a specialist as well. We ought to, therefore, I think, to acquire a thorough knowledge of at least some particular piece, and again for one or two reasons. First, it's only through specialization that new knowledge, distinct from new understanding, is gained. I don't think specialization can give us new understanding. The Einsteins and the great generalizers in the field of science, I suppose, didn't add much to the knowledge of particular bits of science. What they did add was an illuminating understanding of the relations of the different pieces to each other. And then again, if we don't make ourselves specialists in any way some small field, our standard of the mastery of knowledge will be low. If our standard is only the desperately superficial standard of general knowledge, our standard of general knowledge itself will sink lower than it need do. We ought to keep it as high as possible by being real masters in some particular field and trying to lift our general knowledge as nearly as we can to this level of our general knowledge. So let me close with some practical, summing up my practical conclusions. I would say that while everyone ought to be both a specialist and a generalist, it's open to us to concentrate mainly on the one side or on the other, and it's good to follow one's bent in this, subject to taking care not to neglect the side that is the less congenial to oneself. And then there are several foolish quarrels that scholars and scientists ought to drop. They're foolish because these are not really cases of either or, they're cases of both and. There's the quarrel between specialists and the generalists, sometimes a very bitter quarrel, but again, a foolish one, because without both specialists and generalists, understanding couldn't progress. Really, they are partners and should recognize they are indispensable partners to each other. Then the quarrel between the scientists and the humanists, again, a foolish quarrel. I have the impression that the scientists are more conscious they must come to some extent onto the ground of the humanities than the humanists are of the need to have some scientific understanding. But, of course, both need to know something of each other's field, and it's only when you put these two sides of knowledge together that you get an understanding of the universe as it really is. And then, in the field of human affairs especially, there's a especially serious quarrel between the historians and the so-called social scientists, the economists or the sociologists or the anthropologists. The historians, of course, make the narrational approach to human affairs. They follow human affairs moving through the course of time. The social scientists make the analytical and comparative approach. They set a number of different sequences in human affairs side by side and try and make out the likenesses and the differences between them. Now, obviously, both those approaches are indispensable in studying human affairs. Historical approach is indispensable because the essence of life is change. A cross-section of anything living is a falsified picture of it. So you must have the historical, narrational approach. And that would be fine as a single approach if Adam alone had been the only human being would ever be, because then you could follow Adam's career down a single stream of Adam's history. But man is a mammal, there must be at least two human beings of opposite sex originally, if not a few more, and therefore, from the very beginning of human history, there must have been more streams of human affairs than one, because there were more individual lives being lived than one. Soon there were more societies than one, more civilizations than one. And therefore, again, the comparative approach is central. So these two ways of looking at human affairs aren't mutually exclusive, they're complementary to each other. And then again, the quarrel between the students of some particular different sides of human life. The old-fashioned way of looking at human affairs was that politics and war were the essence of human public affairs and of human history. In the 19th century, we learned that economics were also important. And having made that discovery, some people went on to make the old mistake of putting one side of human life, in this case economics instead of politics, into the center and saying economics alone were important, which was just as untrue as to say that politics were alone important. You can do the same with religion, you can do the same with art. All these are falsifications of human life, which is many-sided, and all the sides are equally essential parts of it. All these approaches are necessary, and their respective followers, I would say, oughtn't to fight each other, they ought to cooperate with each other. They ought to do, in fact, what we ought to do on the political plane as between the different states of the world. Well, I hope we're going to have questions, so I'm going to stop here, and I hope we'll have a discussion.
Dr. Toynbee has consented to spend about 15 minutes answering questions. Those of you who may need to leave, if you will leave at this moment, we'll wait just a moment for those who have to go, and then we'll have about 15 minutes of questions, and those who stood up so patiently so long can find a seat.